This is episode 44 of the Fifth Estate podcast, Michael Depesch and the Art of Photography. And we want to welcome to the show to talk about our friends at Blue Apron, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they do this by supporting a more sustainable food system, by setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. It's fantastically affordable, less than $10 per person per meal. Blue Apron, they'll deliver seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. And you can choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. You know, some of the upcoming meals, they sound pretty good. Let me tell you about them. Spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata. Ooh. Sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. Man. Parmesan crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli. Yes, Lord. Baby broccoli and fontina paninis with hard-boiled egg and arugula salad. Oh, ooh, that sounds pretty good, too, if it is vegetarian. Oh, ooh. So if you know, that sounds like something you'd be interested in, let me tell you this. You check out this week's menu, you can get your first three meals for free and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/fifth. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait, y'all. That's blueapron.com/fifth.
All right. Thank you.
That's just the kind of pull we have, folks.
Yeah, it is. It's great. Thank you, Senate Majority Leader McConnell, here on the Fifth Estate, plugging our great sponsor, Blue Apron. So, yeah, just so you, if you, in case you didn't catch it, blueapron.com/fifth, F-I-F-T-H. So, you know, you can go there, get three meals free. The senator likes it. You should, too. So this is Jay here at the Fifth Estate. I'm with Neil, my co-host. Sir, how are you?
Oh, I'm great, Jay. I'm having a wonderful time.
Why are you having a wonderful time?
All sorts of reasons, Jay. Some of them personal, and I won't get into them. But mostly because I'm here talking to you and to our listeners.
It's always a great time, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
It's fantastic.
All right. So we recently had a guest on, Chris Arnotti, who is a storyteller, photographer. And we kind of talked to him about a project that he did. And it kind of spurred the idea maybe of, you know, bringing on somebody who is also in that field and kind of talking to them about, you know, the whole process and things that they do with photography and videography and also where, you know, it kind of works itself into the political realm.
And yeah, you know, and it's fun to, you know, get away from politics, and it's fun to stay away from politics for a little while. So, you know, we're, you know, we like to explore these different realms here. So we're kind of focusing on the arts.
Yes, focusing on the arts. And so we asked a friend of ours, guy that we know, Michael Depesch, to join us here on the show, and he is here with us. Michael, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you, gentlemen?
All right, and thanks for being on, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
So before we kind of get into it, you know, with us asking questions and stuff like that, I mean, I figure one of the things we can kind of talk about is, tell us about who you are, what you do.
Well, these days I'm mainly a freelance photography director, video editor, motion graphics designer, working mostly in television, product marketing, and still doing some politics as well.
Oh, okay. So you're working in TV? Oh, okay. Now, is that like you're talking about the broadcasting, like the networks, or are you doing you're working with, you know, I mean, television now is such a broad spectrum. It could be networks, it could be cable, it could be streaming, you know, it's all.
Yeah, mostly broadcast, doing graphics packages and on location shooting and things for a couple different networks.
Oh, okay.
But that's not really the focus these days. Really trying to push more into product marketing and honestly get out of politics a little bit, which has dominated my my work for the past few years.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody knows about, you know, wanting to sometimes take a break from politics. So let's take a step back. So you know you're doing all this, you know, a lot of creative work.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of where, you know. Tell us about how you got your start doing all this stuff. I mean, everybody has a beginning in terms of, you know, where they, you know, what they've done and the work that they've done. Has this been something you've done pretty much your entire life in terms of, you know, your adult life? Or were you one of these guys that was, a banker and decided to become a photographer instead?
Sure, sure. I mean, honestly, I was a little aimless when I was younger. Never really caught on to the idea of going to college and following that normal path. And when I was about 18 or 19, I started playing with a band, and we had gotten signed, and some complications came up that where it didn't continue, but I ended up skipping college and then pretty much going straight into the workforce, which wasn't my thing either. And it took me about 4 or 5 years of sort of floating around to realize that I needed to do something creative, and I was missing out on that outlet in my life. And I ended up making a move to Portland, Oregon. It's about 10 years ago now, and sort of happened into reigniting a passion for photography and the visual arts and things, which I had, when I was younger, had always had an interest in, even thought about going to college for. But I moved back to Nashville, and a few things fell in place, and I ended up getting a job in that area. And after doing photography for several years and being in that world, I moved into video production and editing and that side of it as well. So it's, can't say I ever really had a goal or a path that I was trying to follow, but things just sort of fell into place and worked out for me, and continue to do so, which has been great.
Mm-hmm. So you moved out to Portland 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of like, was that at the beginning of the Portland hipster renaissance, or
yeah,
had that already been in full swing for a little while by the time you got there?
I mean, it's nothing like it is now. Uh-huh. Out there. But, at that point it was just a welcome change from what I was used to, as mm-hmm. far as the people and the scene. And Nashville at that time was really, it was very much, you know, who do you know and what can they do for you? And relationships weren't happening, and creative work wasn't really happening collaboratively and in the way I wanted it to. I needed a change, and that was great for me.
Right. The atmosphere in Portland, I mean, whatever else comes along with it, there's certainly a lot of creativity mm-hmm. that has flowed through that that area. So I guess my question is sort of like, who influenced you in your style? Had you been cultivating influences before you moved out there? Did you find someone out there, or do you just kind of keep an eye out? Like, so who influenced you?
Actually, I had a friend of mine I met out there, a photographer. Tyler Gould is his name, and he was pretty instrumental in kind of seeing in me that I had an eye for it, and encouraging me and letting me use his gear and all these things, which, you know, a lot of
that's cool. Yeah,
people who start out they sort of dream about having access to all these things, and you know, that was definitely a big push in the right direction for me, to have someone who had been doing this for years say, hey, you know, you've got something. You can do this. Here's everything I have if you need it. As far as influence, though, I mean, I've got to say, I know a lot of photographers that were influenced by the greats and by their specific, you know, favorite photographers, but I had always been more interested in the work of cinematographers and less in still photographers. And that's, I think, more of what crafted my style over time when I got started in photography, was that.
So your influences came more from cinema?
Yeah, I would say so.
Any filmmaker in particular, or just kind of, do you like the big, like, bold visuals? I'm looking at your website and you've got these great shots, you know, very, you know, dramatic, you know, good colors and all that sort of stuff. So anybody in particular, or just
Yeah, I mean, guys like Emmanuel Lubezki, who did Children of Men, Wally Pfister, who did most of Christopher Nolan's work. I always loved his stuff a lot. There are a few others as well. And after I started actually getting into the photography world, I did come across people who, like Annie Leibovitz, who just created sort of a very cinematic look to their photographs. And then guys like Jeremy Cowart and Dave Hill, when I was getting started 10 years ago, they were doing just crazy experimental work that sort of blew my mind. It was like, okay, here's a different way to approach what you're shooting. You don't necessarily have to do what's traditional and what's safe. You can experiment a little bit.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Jeremy's work. Jeremy was a designer who jumped into photography.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his stuff just took off like a rocket. But, you know, he there was just something that he could do that other people didn't necessarily see. So I totally understand that. It's an interesting way to look at it, you know, because you're right. I mean, to sit there and say, well, I've been influenced more by cinematographers than still photographers. But yeah, if you can, it's looking at your work, I mean, you can see based upon, it looks like the lighting and how you've edited it, that it has a, you know, if it almost looks like still photos from a feature film is graded in that particular way. At least that's the way I see it. But and everybody who's listening to this, you know, you go over to michaeldepesch.com and you can see his work there. There's photography, there's videos, there's some really good stuff. And you've worked with some pretty big names. I mean, you know, Charlie Daniels is on there on your website.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to shoot his album cover a few years back, which was a lot of fun. Worked with Joy Williams before the Civil Wars blew up. It was an interesting start because it seemed like, oddly enough, through Twitter and through making connections in social media, I was able to meet a lot of people and work with them that I probably wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
Right. Well, being in Nashville helps, right? I mean, that's
sure.
Yeah, such a musical town. So. But there's also got to, I mean, but at the same time, you know, your work has to stand out because there's probably photographers are probably a dime a dozen in Nashville, I'm mistaken.
No. And that was truthfully, I'm not exactly proud of this, but after I came back from Portland and really tried to make a push for the photography world, I feel like at that point, everyone was moving here. It was just the beginning of on the cusp of that, younger millennial crowd, mm-hmm. Creative crowd especially, that just decided to move to Nashville. And with that came a lot of photographers. And there were a lot of really great photographers that came in that wave too. And it was really about that time where I started professionally moving more into video and photography fell more by the wayside. Obviously, everything you learn in the still photography world, most of it will translate to video. So it's not like everything's lost. It's not like it was pointless, but I think that's more where I wanted to be anyway. I just didn't know how to get there.
Oh, okay. So like if you're doing something, so let's kind of, you know, are you more of a, when you're approaching a project that you've been assigned, are you more of a conceptual person or are you more the execution person? Because personally for me, I'm not conceptual. It's like if somebody was to sit there and say, Jay, come up with an idea, I'd be like, I'll try, but it'd probably be stupid. But if you had a concept and then you said, Jay, go out and execute it, I'd be like, yeah, no problem. I can do that. So where do you find yourself,
Jay,
on that spectrum?
That's like our podcast relationship. I come up with these great ideas and then I get you to do all the work.
That's right. Yeah. I don't do anything. Neil makes it all brilliant and I just kind of like put it together.
That's a good question. I think I'm, I do a bit of both. A lot of times I'll come up with an idea and then try to find someone to let me do that idea. And those are going to be more passion projects or personal projects. A lot of times, you know, music videos, things like that, where you can dream a little more. And, but I've done both. I do like, working on treatments and coming up with ideas and conceptualizing. At other times, it's nice to have someone who has already thought everything through and has a great idea and says, hey, here's what I want to do, make this happen. So it really, it's project dependent, I would say, but it's always good to collaborate with a client, with an artist, and hear what their vision is, even if it's not fully fleshed out, and to help them from the other side say, okay, here's what my idea is, here's what I'd like to do, here, let me help you take it from, you know, point A to point B, and we'll try to make something together that makes us both happy.
Now,
and
so
Michael, go ahead, Jay.
No, I was going to say, when you have two, so how does that work sometimes, especially if you're working with another artist? So you have two artists kind of like together trying to do this thing. Do you find that it's easier for the both of you to kind of work together, or do you find that there's sometimes a bit more of a clash of styles because they have their vision and you have yours? So does it work? Is there much contrast, or do you find that, you know, the two visions together meld into something really good? How does that usually work with you?
I mean, it's really dependent upon the two people, like any relationship. I mean, there's a reason why some of the greatest directors have their directors of photography that they always use, because they know they can work well with them. They know the end product is going to be great. And then you have some too that continue to use the same people, even though it isn't good, but they're just loyal. So it really depends on the project. Every once in a while you'll come across somebody who, you click with, you have a similar vision. You work well off each other. You build each other up. And then you'll find people who want to take control, want to try to change everything, control everything. And in those cases, sometimes you have to, you know, step away or decline.
But. So, Michael, do you find you have the same kind of dynamic, you know, when it comes to both your professional work and your personal work, or do you approach those things very differently? Like when you're just sort of doing it for yourself, you know, how do you approach your video projects?
Sure. I would say that professional work, most of the time, the client is hiring you because they've seen something you've done. They know what you can do, and they want to repeat that. They're not looking for you to be risky or experiment or do something outside of your comfort zone, if you want to call it that, visually. But then you have your personal projects, where that's really when you grow. That's when you make mistakes, give yourself the ability to make mistakes, because that's really the only way to learn, is to try something and fail at it and then do better the next time. Last thing you want to do on a professional project is fail. So it's a very different way to approach it. You really want to instill confidence in the client that, hey, this is what I can do. I've done it before. And every once in a while, you will have a client that is willing to let you experiment and try something different and new, which is great.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the actual nuts and bolts here. You know, video, obviously not the same animal as photography, but when it comes to like prepping and the whole like vision of it, you know, what are the factors that go into video as opposed to photography?
I would say the biggest thing, with photography, you've captured a single moment from a single position of a camera, of a single scene. And then with video, the physical motion of the camera from one place to another within a scene can speak volumes. It can help tell the story. It can tell us something, tell the audience something that the characters don't know. It can reveal something that we didn't know prior. So there's a lot more planning that goes into video, I would say, especially in cinema, just because there's so much motion involved, not just what's being captured on screen, but the camera physically itself. So that does determine how you light a scene, how you set up a scene. There's a lot of sins you can cover with still photography, just by forcing perspective or shooting in particular ways.
So, well, let me ask you this too. So now you are, you know, you're one of the many people that works in this business on their own. Mm-hmm. You worked with a company for a while, but now you're kind of back on your own. Am I right? You're kind of freelance?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so that's a scary thing for a lot of people. So what kind of challenges do you have in making sure that you've always got enough work lined up to keep, you know, keep yourself afloat, which, you know, to keep yourself from having to go back to, let's say, for whatever reason, something fell apart and you had to go back to the corporate world. You know, what are the challenges that you face every day that keep you going to be able to make sure that, you know, okay, next week I've got to work on this and that, and the following week that, next month is this, that kind of thing?
I mean, honestly, not that I want to go back to the corporate world. It's not the worst thing to have one client on which you can focus your attention, especially if it's a good client, especially if it's one that shares your vision. So that's not really my goal, is to stay out of that, because I would, if I found the right client, I would gladly put my time into that. But I would say what I've done is found clients that have specific needs on a monthly basis, and, you know, allotted a certain amount of time to work with those companies. So I've been able to, have a certain amount of my month devoted to them, and then open up a certain amount of my month to pick up other projects as well. So it takes the stress away to have some retainer clients, I would say, if you can find them. It's not always possible, though. It's a lot of people struggle in this business to, you know, from month to month, because they're just picking up whatever they can find. And I think that too pushes you into a place where you have to pick up work that you don't want. And when you're trying to, which, you know, I think I've dealt with for years now, doing, up until recent years, doing whatever comes your way, just because it's money and you got to pay the bills.
Right.
And then what you're doing is you're not building a portfolio. You're not building a body of work that you're proud of. And then when you go to show a client, a prospective client, what you can do, you have very limited amount to give them of what you're proud of and what you want to show. And you can end up falling into this spiral where, you're doing nothing but shooting weddings and you hate weddings, or, you know, and that's really more the worry for me than, you know, having to find a corporate job.
Do you agree with this philosophy? Chase Jarvis said, you know, there's a lot of times when, you know, if you are, you know, there's a potential client who can only pay, let's say, $500 for something you might normally charge $5,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just throwing a number out there. And he said, you know, well, it always comes with the promise of later work. You know, and he said, you know, that $500 client is never going to turn into the $5,000 client, because what they're going to do is, when they can afford to pay $5,000, they're going to go to somebody who does $5,000 work.
Yeah.
So do you agree with that? Is there a point where you have to say, you know what, I'm not the right fit for you at this price point, and let me kind of, you know, you said there's times when you have to kind of take on stuff maybe you don't necessarily want to do. But is there times too that you have to sit there and say, no, I can't do this, not at that price point. Here's somebody who may be able to help you out, who's just breaking in or something like that. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it at times to turn work down?
I've done it a lot. And I think it's absolutely necessary. The last thing you want to do is devalue your work. When you're just starting out, you don't really have a value yet to your work. You're still building enough of a portfolio to prove that you can actually do it. What I ended up doing most of the time, especially with photography when I started out, is I would rather take $0 and have full creative control over a shoot, then take much, much less than what it's worth, with the expectation from the client that I have control over most of what happens in the shoot. And that actually worked out well, because it, yeah, sure, you're working for free, but you're also not trying to complete someone else's vision for no money. So yeah, I mean, in the video world, yeah, it's, I think a lot of people just out of desperation will take those jobs for very little money, but you're right. It devalues your work. You gain a reputation of being that cheap, you know, videographer or photographer. And, it doesn't really do anything to help you in the future, I would say.
Interesting. So, Michael, let me know if you agree with this. Creative people mm-hmm. who are involved in creative fields, they are never done learning. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's safe to say that you're always growing and developing in different directions, sometimes diametrically opposed directions, but there's always this change happening, right? Mm-hmm. So in that respect, you know, what do you as an artist want to get better at, and why? Which, by the way, isn't an opportunity to list all your faults as an artist for any potential clients who may be listening. This is
Michael. Tell us what you suck at. So,
I think honestly, the one of the biggest things is learning how to tell a story without using words. I know that sounds really cliche, but that's really what you're trying to do with any type of visual art, especially video, is capture something in a way that the audience understands what's happening without needing words. It's not always possible, but it all comes down to subtlety. It comes down to trying to convey an emotion, and that can happen in so many different ways, and there's so many different moving parts that come together to make that work. The other thing is, I'm never, and I think probably most creative people would say this, it's really tough to get what's in your brain onto the screen. I think it's a constant, from project to project, learning, okay, this is what I want. This is what I see in my head. How can I get this into reality? How can I make this happen? And I think you're disappointed every time, less and less so the more you do it. But I think that's growth. It goes back to what you're saying. You're constantly learning. You're constantly growing, because the medium is constantly growing and changing. And you can't stay stagnant. You can't follow every trend either. You have to find your style. You have to find what's unique. And unique is a brand that you can sell. But if you get stagnant in that, people are going to move on to the next thing. So it's tough. I think what I want to get better at is not trying to follow every trend and really trying to find a real solid vision of what my look is, what my feel is, something that people can, you know, look at and say, okay, that I know who shot that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, talking about trends, actually, it leads into another question. You know, everybody now carries a video camera in their pocket. Mm-hmm. Just about everyone. And that changes how people interact with media that they encounter. It changes how people create media. And so I want to get your take on, you know, how advances in technology like cell phone cameras, how have they changed how photography works? And is it a good thing? I mean, is it to our benefit?
Yeah, man. It's a mixed bag, honestly. I mean, your iPhone can do more than what, you know, professional video equipment could do 10 years ago. And that, in a way, is a really good thing, because those with a vision and no budget can actually create something that they couldn't before without spending a lot of money. But with that comes the idea that everybody's a photographer, everybody's a videographer. Right.
It's like cat videos and vines. That's
which there's a place for that. And I think we've seen that, you know, viral video is something that wouldn't exist if it weren't for readily available video cameras in our pockets. It's, you know, created things like Instagram, where you have people who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars because they take pictures of their dogs, literally. And that is, you know, that's an advancement in some ways, because people are able to consume it in a different way that they couldn't before. It creates a need to create it in a different way as well. But it also, you've got people who are now turning, more so than ever before, turning those cameras toward themselves and not toward, you know, not outward.
Right.
You see pictures all the time of someone posting a selfie saying, I'm at the airport. And it's like, okay, well, I see you. I see hundreds of pictures of you doing these different things. You're not showing me where you are. You're showing me you in a certain area, which I think is really dangerous. It's a slippery slope. And I'm going to go on a tangent here, but we've really gone down a bad path, I think, when it comes to most of the photos we share, most of the video we share. It's mostly very, very selfish. And I understand the idea that you can keep up with friends now. You can see what everyone's up to. You can see people's kids and pets and all that kind of stuff. But I think we've reached a saturation point at the same time where it's really tough to break through with original content. And I think it still comes down to good storytelling, though. No matter how good our camera phones get, no matter, you know, if you're shooting 4K video on your phone, that you can have a 4K video of a really crappy, you know, image, and it doesn't make it good. Yeah. So I think that's,
you can't
really
polish a turd, right?
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, I think you're really onto something here, Michael, because, you know, it's this sort of self-centeredness that you see in the selfie culture. And my example of this, I was at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris last summer. And I know that makes me sound horribly elitist, but at least my French accent is poor. Anyway, so here's the thing. So they had an exhibit of Van Gogh. And they had this famous self-portrait of Van Gogh in this exhibit. And it was, of course, mobbed, right? And everybody was there. But here's what they were doing. They were sitting there mobbing it with their phones out in front of them, taking photographs of this portrait. And if they weren't doing that, they were positioning themselves in front of it, in front of the camera, and taking a selfie with the portrait. For what purpose? I can't really guess, but what it struck me at that time was these people are not experiencing where they are. It's not even about so much the content they're sharing with people. They're just going to share a crappy photo of something that you can buy a print of in the gift shop, you know, it's a high quality print, but they are not even really looking at the portrait. So my solution to this was to step right up to the little guard rope and examine the brush strokes of this Van Gogh painting for a full 2.5 minutes, which blocked everyone's shot. It was just close enough to block absolutely everybody in this museum's shot. And there were people dancing around behind me with their phones, like waiting for me to move on. And, you know, I got a thrill out of that because I'm a jerk. But... But it was just like this little protest that I had to do, because, like, be where you are and stop making terrible photographs of great art. Experience the great art.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. But we live in a culture that has, where restaurants are ranked on how good their lighting is for photographing the food for Instagram and how well lit their bathrooms are for selfies. Even in Nashville here, we've got places that advertise for their selfie mirrors in the bathroom. And it's just like, are you going to a restaurant to enjoy the food, to enjoy your company, or are you seeking out places that where you can make your life look better than it really is, and you're trying to create this persona and this vision for what you think your life should be, but doesn't actually exist. And that's really where we are. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting old. I have no idea.
I know. I feel like I could go on an old man rant about how, you know, taking selfies and pictures of your food actually makes your service worse because you're holding up the wait staff. But we should move on.
I mean, I understand, because there was a guy who, I can't remember who it was now, somebody who did, who's a travel writer, and said that he implored people, stop taking your cameras with you when you go on vacation, especially places you've never been before. You're spending so much time snapping photos of this place that you've never been to instead of just sitting there and taking it in, that you're going to look at the photos, but you're barely going to remember what you saw, because all you're doing is looking at images. So I kind of agree with that.
I do. I then, on the other hand, I love shooting when I travel. I think it opens up your mind to something you've never seen before, and you see things in a different way. Unlike when you drive around your city that you've seen every day for 10 years.
Right.
The difference is your photos are worth looking at.
But I think that brings up an interesting point. There are ways you could sit there and live somewhere for 20 years and somebody could come along and photograph that city in ways that you've never seen it before. Yeah. And you'd be like, I've never seen that. I never saw that. I never pictured that. Just to kind of back up to the the technology portion, where you're shooting video. Have you shot any video on film, or has it all been digital?
It's all been digital.
Okay. I was reading an article. Director James Gray insisted, there was a movie he was filming where he insisted on using film, and he was talking about how the price of film, like processing, like went up, like all of a sudden within the last few years it's become this boutique kind of thing, to where processing was like 15 cents a foot and now it's like 37 cents a foot, and so it added like $750,000 immediately to the budget of this movie. But he insisted on shooting it on film. There's people that haven't gone to digital yet, whereas somebody like Robert Rodriguez, the moment that digital was available, he said, I'm never going to shoot on film again. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. This is kind of funny where I see millennials, because, you know, as a photographer, I started out, you know, shooting film. There was no digital. And so I always used to laugh at kind of like people that would sit there and say, I've got film I'm going to shoot. It was this mysterious like thing that suddenly somebody unfurled, you know, from the bottom of the earth, and they found something that they've never used before. But you've shot with film. Would you take the opportunity to shoot a movie or a video with film if given the chance?
I mean, I've shot still with film, and I like the idea of not having instant gratification of seeing what you just shot and being able to correct that, and you get what you get. At the same time, it's frustrating with video or with actual shooting moving film. I think I would. I would. It would have to have an advantage over digital for me, and I think that's why some directors still insist on it. That's why the Star Wars films that are coming out are being shot mostly on 65mm film, and P.T. Anderson and other directors are still insisting on it, because it's still like a 65mm camera. And that size film, you still can't replicate that look digitally. I mean, we'll get there eventually, but it's
gorgeous.
Yeah. It's a different perspective than any other type of medium. And you can't really even put your finger on why. It's just something that you feel and you see. And if you want that much control over your film, to where, you know, you want to be able to convey something visually, you'll go to those lengths if you have the budget to do it. So I think I would love to be a part of a project that did that, but I also know that it's not really feasible on a budget these days.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, exactly. I mean, you know, because you can now with DSLRs, you know, kind of replicate what film looks like when you're shooting it with 24 frames per second, right? So, you know, there is that kind of advantage, and that goes back again to the technology, is that it you know, certainly allows some greater creativity, but you know, like you said, and getting away from so much about the selfie culture, but do we also have like a saturated market of people who are making stuff that, you know, I think it has opened up opportunities, especially when it comes to the new outlets that we have for like television, you know? So there's people that may not have gotten a job 10 years ago or 15 years ago who can do that now, thanks to Netflix and Amazon and AMC and all these different new outlets that are opening up, giving people with new visual styles and obviously a lot more creative control to do their thing. And do you think that's a good thing, or do you like it to be more competitive so you can kind of get your way in there, or you know, do you like this kind of like open season?
I think advancement in technology and methods of consumption, I think that's always a good thing. I think that always opens up markets for entrepreneurs to come in and try something different. I mean, you have people, you know, remember when Vine was a thing, you had guys making 6-second videos that were a totally new form of art that we hadn't seen before.
Right.
Very much like Twitter, where it changed one-liner jokes and things like that. You give people a new medium and people will find a way to create in that medium. I think it's almost always a good thing. If you look at some of the advertising that's happening now on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, you've got to capture people's attention in a much shorter span of time, and you have to do it in a really creative way. So I'm not against that whatsoever. I'm all for, you know, bring it on. It's people who are stuck in the past are going to fall behind. I think it's always good to move forward in advance. But again, the basics of storytelling are always going to be that's going to be at the root of what makes something good.
Right. Right, because it can, yeah, like you said, visually it can look terrific, but if the story stinks, it doesn't really, it's not going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So, I mean, what about, in the future, you know, would you like to be the, you know, the DP on like on a feature film? Is that something you'd like to do? Or are you kind of more in your comfort zone with, you know, maybe television production, shorter kind of things? I mean, some people have these aspirations that they want to be able to, you know, walk up and get an Oscar for best cinematography. Is that something, is that something you would want to do at some point?
I would love the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think that it's also something that you don't just jump into. You definitely have to work your way up to. Okay. And it's, you know, it's not something that, it's not something that is just easy to fall into. You have to know the right people. You have to work on the right projects. You have to have the motivation and the right mindset for it. But so I don't know. I think a lot of people probably didn't set out to do that. You've got guys who are music video directors who were tapped to shoot feature films, and they did fantastic jobs. And I bet you they never thought that they would have been great at it. So we're definitely in a different world now, where the idea of what cinema is going to change, just because it's being consumed in different ways. And like you were talking about Netflix and streaming services, distribution has changed, which changes what projects are picked up. Something that could have been considered extremely risky before is now greenlit and given a smaller budget, which you can now work within because technology's changed to the point where you don't have to spend $100 million on a picture. So yeah, I mean, it's a new world. And I think I would definitely consider something like that in the future.
Do you find yourself that you do you find that you're good where you're at in Nashville, or is there going to be a you know, you'll find at some point, you know, to kind of expand, you'll have to move to, you know, LA or New York or something like that?
A lot of friends have moved to New York or LA, especially those who wanted to get into film and feature production. But, I mean, you know, this being in Atlanta, you've got a lot of production happening there in television, and film. Nashville is still a growing town, and it's still, kind of, I think there's a future for it here. And I think at the moment I'd rather be part of something here than abandon ship and go somewhere else.
Interesting.
Fascinating. Well, we've been talking to Michael Depesch, and you can check his work out at his website, michaeldepesch.com. That is DEPPISCH.com. And thanks so much for being with us, man.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It was a really good convo.
Yeah.
Do you have any upcoming projects that you're excited about? Anything you want to tell us about? Or
I've got actually, oddly enough, I've been wanting to write and shoot a short film, so I'm in the very beginning planning stages of that. Probably something I'd work on next year over the winter. Got a couple marketing campaigns and a music video, but nothing huge.
But there's still
that's
work.
Great, man.
You're still
that's
busy.
Exciting.
So that's good.
So yeah. we have one more piece of business to conclude, sir. And this is our one gotcha question.
Hold on.
Mm-hmm. that we lay on our guests at the end. We don't tell you what it's going to be in advance. We're rather merciless, you know, when it comes to the answer. It's something Jay and I disagree on rather strongly. There is a right and a wrong answer here. Just depends on who thinks you're right and who thinks you're wrong. But why don't we just go ahead and get into it? Michael Depesch, is the show Seinfeld overrated?
Ooh. By whom?
Oh, by you. Just in general. Is it overrated by society? You know, you can also judge it on the merits of its cinematography if you like.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think it was pretty groundbreaking. And oh, man, that's tough, though.
I think I see which way the wind is blowing, though. Yeah. You're saying
I don't
no.
think it's overrated.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's the right answer.
That meets my expectations. Unfortunately, the world is against me on this question.
I mean, it's no Big Bang Theory. Like, I know you love that show. But...
Oh, my gosh. Oh, man.
True.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. Yeah. Well, Michael, once again, thanks for taking time out to, you know, to join us here. We appreciate it. And,
yeah, no worries, guys.
Yeah. You know, hopefully I think our audience is pretty diverse. So it's like, stop. Okay. You know, it's not just politics. So, I'm sure, I know that people are going to like this, discussion. So they like the break, which is nice. So I appreciate it. And, wish you all success. And, when you finally do get to go, hopefully we'll be watching you at some point when you're accepting that Oscar for best cinematography. We appreciate it. That would be fun.
Yeah. Sure. You better be waiting for a while, but I appreciate that.
Hey, man, whatever, however long it takes, you know,
that's
so,
true.
Yeah. So anyway, by the way, you know what? We didn't bring this up in the beginning because I was just so enthralled with the fact that Mitch McConnell was helping us out. But hey, just remember, guys, you listening, if you like this podcast, go out to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a star rating. 5 stars is always the best. We love that. And then we do love the reviews because that just keeps us more relevant. People want to sit there and listen to us jabber with people far more talented and smarter than we are.
Indeed. And, you know, the 5 stars are sort of an expectation at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, if you give us a 3-star review or 4-star review, get out of here. Come on, whatever.
Exactly.
We're giving you this fantastic hashtag content for free. Come on. 5 stars, guys. 5 stars.
All right. Michael, thanks again, everybody. MichaelDeppisch.com. Check out his work. I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Dewing. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.